session number 12035.
Reel one.
Temple, reel one. So, could I ask you then, Bishop Temple, about your background? You know, whereabouts you were born and brought up, and the sort of family you came from?
Yes, I was born in Patna, in India, in 1916. My father was a sanitary engineer, which he always said brought the family down to ground. So my mother did what all wives did in those days of English people working there, which was to spend the winter in India with her husband, carting her young children backwards and forwards till the age of 8, when they were dumped in a school, in a prep school or boarding school in England. My father was much more of the radicals. He had the radical in him from my grandfather, of course, was very radical and had known great poverty in his youth, Frederick, brought up by a very poor mother indeed. My mother was much more conservative, or didn't like to offend sort of public opinion and other things like that, and came from another clerical family. Her father had been Bishop of Calcutta, and there's a bit of Irish on that side of the family. Her mother was extremely and deliciously inconsequential and Irish, and my mother had some of this in her as well. And I think that was the start. And so I went backwards and forwards with my mother, but it became a very arrogant small boy. Had already had 13 voyages on the piano by the age of 8. Felt I knew all about it and was very scornful of adults travelling for the first time. They didn't know how to behave at Port Said or Suez. and what you did in the East properly, and I was always telling them. So there. Now, and then at the age of 8, I had a fearful nurse, which my parents didn't realize at all, who bullied me, mistreated me, and also made me write innumerable lines. And if I failed to finish something at lunch, I wasn't allowed any tea until I'd eaten whatever it was I'd left at lunch, which was cold by then. So I've loathed blancmange all my life, because wobbly, bright blancmange would always appear before a lovely tea of cakes and jam and other things. Belonged to the age, of course, of the upper-class English, where the parents only saw the child for an hour in the evening, and my mother felt that was entirely long enough, and was otherwise in the hands of this nurse who behaved sweetly with my parents, but bullied me, beat me, Chester, and threatened me with various things as a boy. Then at 8 I was dumped in an equally appalling prep school, but again, the parents didn't realise, I think, until after I'd left, the headmaster ran away with the music master's wife, and that was typical of what was happening in the school. But it's amazing how tough one is. All the small boys seem to survive through that. Straight on with the, and then rugby. All temples go to rugby, and I was always ill as a small boy, ill most spring times, and so didn't get in very well into rugby, rather low down. And of course, although he's a marvellous person, the vision of my uncle sort of haunted me. I was always expected to do better than that. Consider your Uncle William and this and that. But rugby was very fierce and very tough in those days, particularly the schoolhouse. The sixth form were allowed, of course, to beat the fags and the others. And there was this awful institution of fag calls where any sixth form could call at any time of the day, fag, and then all the fags had to run to where the call came from, and the last to arrive did the job. And the worst thing that they did was usually when we were all squashed in an absolutely medieval little dining hall to call then, and one had to leap out over the table, knocking down one's precious marmalade or jam that had come from school, come from home, and crash up the stairs to where they were having their tea, and see if you didn't arrive too late. Going downstairs, I was all right because I was fairly big and tough, and all you did then was to leap onto the back of the smallest boy there, who then crashed to the ground and bruised and and tottering, arrived last, had to do the job. So I didn't care for rugby very much, though I think it's a good school. My Uncle William always said about rugby, he said rugby is an efficient, strict school, and rugbyans are not nice, but if I want anyone to do anything well, I would ask a rugbyan. And he was at rugby himself. And so that was his description of rugby. Then on to Balliol, which I loved, possibly in contrast to rugby, 4 years there, reading Onomods, the first part of the classical course, and then history. And that took one up to 1939.
During all this time, had you thought at all about war and pacifism?
Yes, it started to come, particularly because I had wonderful times with my Uncle William, because very often when my mother was abroad, instead of spending the winter with her mother in Putney, which I loved, because she was incredibly free for those days with teenagers. I had a key and I could be out any time in London to age 12, 13, 14, till late at night and come in, and she didn't worry. And there was the nice occasion when in the spring, when my mother had come home, and we hadn't yet moved down to our own home in Sussex, I arrived in late to find my grandmother pacing the landing, and I said, "What on earth's the matter, Grandmama? Your mother's not in yet." And so her own child, aged over 50, was much more of a worry than her grandson in the early teens. And so I would spend quite a lot of Christmas holidays and some bits of spring holidays with my uncle, and drive with him when he was going to things. He said, "I have a lot of confirmations, but you needn't come. They needn't come to any that you don't want to, and go for walks round about, but we can talk in the car." And he, of course, was pro-military action. I mean, he left the League of... He left the Labour Party when it refused to back the League of Nations for sanctions against Italy invading Abyssinia. I mean, he was a great believer in collective security and would have liked us to have stopped Hitler when he moved into the Ruhr and the Rhine, and that probably would have stopped the Second World War if action had been taken then. But he also had the interesting point that he said, "But there must be some pacifists amongst us, because people can stand for different ideals, And he used to say, sort of, England is worth fighting for, but only if there are sufficient pacifists in it. And then was very stern with me, because he said, of course, if you're going to be a pacifist, you must be ready not to accept anything from the state which is fighting to protect you. You must be ready to accept no pay, sick pay if disabled, or any of the things that the state provides. And then I shall respect your integrity. If you do that, you must stand totally for saying that this you can't do, and this I respect, and this we need several people like that. And he, of course, always stood for the rights of conscientious objection to be heard, and not to be bullied or dealt wrongly with. During the war, and in the end, I havered, I suppose, a bit as to what I would do, but then slowly was moved more, because ordination was starting to be a flicker in the mind. For a long time, in early teens, it had been the last thing I wanted to do, because I was fed up with adults getting into corners when at home and saying, sort of, and what's the boy going to do? And they, well, we hope he's going to follow his uncle. so was determined for quite a time not to do that. But that slowly changed. And the war, aren't we?
And you were saying that ordination was a flicker.
Yes, a flicker in the mind, and that made me feel that I didn't feel, if I was ordained, that I could have taken part in fighting and shot someone. And of course, it was true that chaplains and the forces weren't expected to do this either. And so I approached the unit, I suppose, from a very much more individualistic conscientious objection point of view, that I felt and found it quite difficult, and used to have great arguments with others in the unit, because I would argue, well, no, I know it's right for some people to be fighting, but not for me. And I found several of the friends some not, like John Bailey, very wishy-washy in really what they believed. I mean, and the best friends did say to me that, of course, we Quakers depend on what we call convinced friends, friends who've come into our movement from something else. And birthright friends tend not to be very strong in definite arguments. It's more sort of an attitude to peace, an outlook for this or that. And I found this to be so. I think that when one tried to do the regular thing that my uncle used to do, say, "Well, what are you going to do?" Sort of when someone enters your house and is about to, not necessarily to kill you, but to kill your relations and friends. What will your attitude be there? And they seemed often not to have an answer to that. And one profound, again, he always made his profound remarks in such simple and yet startling statements. My uncle said to me, pacifism is all right for you and the right thing for you at the moment, but I shall love to see whether, when you're married and have children, you will still be a pacifist. And I have to admit, when after the war, one heard things about the communists coming into Greece and taking away small children to brainwash them, I sort of turned to Joan then and said, "In that case, I think I would resist. I mean, not so much the physical thing that might be happening to one's children, but they might be totally brainwashed into something that one thought wrong and evil. And so I think there are moments in one's life when one changes that. But now I think, now with children off one's hand and responsible for their own decisions, and with no other responsibilities but one's own, I've returned to being a pacifist.
It would seem your uncle had very carefully thought this through.
Oh, right through, yes.
Yes, he probably was very interested, was he, in pacifism. You know, the concept and the dilemma for young men in World War II, would you say? You know, in bearing in mind his position in the church.
I think he just was very interested in everything. I mean, this incredible brain, which helped by a totally photographic memory. He never forgot anything he'd ever read. I think at about he realized he'd got this when at about the age of 10. He found it quoted to about 200 lines of Shelley by heart, somewhere without anything, and he used to say to one sort of thing, if you turn to my book there, it's three quarters of the way through it, I think, about three quarters of the way down on the right-hand side. You'll see that argument. And listening to sermons, because I got to know his works very well, I would hear sort of him doing the argument down one book, and then there'd be a joining sentence or two, and we'd move into where it continued in another, somewhere else. In that way. So, no, he was, and of course with his position, because he was thought rather warlike in a way in the his arguments for collective security, but he worked right into this. I mean, he believed very much what Reinhold Niebuhr taught then, that there were the two things sort of that you had to the state had a duty which was often different from that of the individual. I mean, the thing that the Roman that some moments countries have a right to martyr people, and the martyrs have a right to be martyred. They're too, a great believer in sort of the two tensions can be held together. And this was a tremendous help to me, because the rest of my family were totally opposed. I mean, my mother would accept anything that Uncle William said, so if William thinks it's all right. And my father, disappointed, I think, because he was a colonel in the volunteer army in India, and instantly became something when the Second World War, he was back in England then, when the Second World War came, and to start with, when it wasn't certain what I'd do, I wondered whether to join the Citizens Advice Bureau or anything like that. They were a bit worried as to what other people would feel, I think. But in a sense, the FAU was a cop-out, because people could say, oh, well, that's all right, a frontline ambulance unit. I mean, would have needed more moral courage, in a way, to stay at home and risk more, but to be in a frontline hospital unit for no pay. Even though we don't agree with his argument, but young men do silly things, that's all right. We can accept that. So they were happy then. One sister of mine, with whom I'm dearly in love now and have been since the war, I mean, at the beginning of the war, said, in 1940, said, of course, if the Germans land in England and were to land in our garden, I'd have to shoot you first because I wouldn't know what you might do. Apart from Uncle William, the family situation would have been difficult, but he backed me throughout there.
Did you have any friends who were pacifists? I wondered if you had any group support at this time.
Well, Stephen Verney, of course, were there, because we were at Balliol together. And Russell Atchison, who looked as if he was going to be a pacifist, then joined up. Stephen was the main person, I think. And Joan's brother, John, for whom it didn't occur, because he was training to be a doctor, reading to be a doctor, and when he'd finished his degree at Oxford, joined the army as a doctor. But he was a very close friend. In fact, that's how Joan and I knew each other, because John was my best friend at Oxford. And so I knew the stable was good. There, I used to meet Joan very often there. And
did you have anything to do with the anti-war movement? I'm thinking of things like the Peace Pledge Union or the Fellowship for Reconciliation, The Anglican Pacifist Fellowship.
Quietly and rather secretly, because at that moment, till I was sure, the family would have been rather disapproving, I think, and trying. So yes, I used to get stuff from them and be very, very much interested, but I never joined or anything like that. And my father was always he was determined we get to know Beethoven very well, and so every Friday. And I'm grateful now. Every Friday from Sussex, we drove up to a prom concert in the there would be some good lady outside writing peace news, sort of selling peace news in rather a prim little voice, and he would say, "That's typical of them. That's typical of them. Peace news, peace news." And so I thought, well, I mustn't let him know that. Thinking that way, I think.
When did you have your tribunal?
I'd already joined the unit. That came in the summer of 40, and it was the stiff one in London, which was recognised. They were rather stiffer than most, and so I don't think it was a unanimous decision. I mean, luckily, at one moment it looked as if I might be told I must join the medical corps rather than the French ambulance unit. But then they sort of retreated and withdrew. And the one who was clearly arguing in favour of me won the day and said, "Well, as he's in the French ambulance unit, let him stay." I think there. We'd had very tough time that summer when we got back from Finland. I was down at a unit in Gloucester, in charge of a unit in Gloucester, and the town council tried to a great number of them wanted, although they were very short in the hospital, wanted to throw us out. They couldn't bear the idea of the conches, the brave soldiers back from Dunkirk, being treated and washed and bathed and looked after by conches. But luckily a few of them sort of said, "Well, what are we going to do? We're getting them for no pay at all and only upkeep." And pure finance made let the unit stay in the end there. And
I suppose it was a bad time to have a tribunal, really, wasn't it?
Especially just Dunkirk had just happened, yes, and the last thing, he wanted everyone rallying to the cause rather than not. That's true.
Would you say there was more publicity about your tribunal because of your relationship with the Archbishop William Temple?
I didn't notice it at the time, I don't think. I've had those quite enough. I mean, it was enough of ordeal.
Was it?
Well, yes, I think it's the first time I'd sort of been in the dock, as it were. But really grateful again there for the arguments and discussions I'd had with Uncle William. And he, of course, was quite incredible when I would write immense, arrogant undergraduate letters to him. About the situation, why couldn't the church and everything do more? Yeah, he would reply by return in his own hand, often in a train, immense letters too. Once I sort of said, this must be a fearful bore to you, and he said, no, it's very good for me to find myself on the other side of the fence, being thought to be an old fogey and conservative, whereas most of the time I'm thought far too radical. And so I still have these wonderful letters from him.
Did you have any support, you know, when you went to your tribunal? Did anyone sort of come and support you or give letters of support?
Oh, well, Paul Cadbury wrote, yes, I think, I forget who. And my dear mother then was there, sort of in the gallery, came up and watched. And had been trying to say sort of, well, whatever you're asked to do, it'll be all right, won't it? In that way, I think.
Can you remember the questions they asked you? The sorts of questions?
I don't know. Why are you not prepared to do this? And so sort of... And a bit sort of... why won't you, if you take this position, join the Royal Army Medical Corps? And so then I had to say there, well, I want to be in something more corporate that is making this witness in this way. I think that was the main thing, because having taken this rather individual pacifist line and having been honest enough to say it's right for some people to be fighting, and so one would be asked sort of, well, are you so much, you thought to be so much better than others, yeah. And of course again one had A.D. Lindsay, the Master Balliol, who used to have marvellous open sessions at Balliol in 38-39, where each week who wanted could go and talk there. And he, who also felt in the end, he wrote a marvellous little book, The Two Moralities, sort of what you must do as a citizen and what you must do as an individual. He used to say about those of us that were thinking of pacifism, be sure you're not just wanting others to wash your dirty linen and get their hands soiled on your behalf.
What would you say the basis of your pacifism was at that stage? You said earlier on that you, because of the Bible, you felt you couldn't kill. Could you explain a little more?
Well, I thought if we're called to be like Christ, Peter's sword in the garden there, and being told when he cut off the high priest's servant's ear, and being told to sheathe his sword, and Christ saying to Pilate, sort of that, if I wanted that armies of angels that I could use, that he decided to go right through in this way, and that it would be terrible, but in the long run is this the way really to do things. And one had been, of course, by then tremendously impressed by what Mahatma Gandhi had done in India. Although again my uncle used to put there, I said, you can only behave like that if the society itself is fairly reasonable, civilized. and has a good morality. He said Hitler would just have killed Gandhi straight away, and maybe not the same effect there. And he was always very interesting on the difference between right back on German pacifism, because he said the fundamental flaw in Lutheranism is that it believes the state has the right to do anything, but unless it invades, as it were, the kitchen of the church, it mustn't invade the religious side. And this is true of Nimola, that it's only because the state invaded church doctrine and belief that he was a pacifist. I mean, he'd been a submarine commander, and he before that in the First War, and that it goes down to that. So I think the Bible side was just the general effect that Christ's life had on one there, rather than specific texts. So it was enough of of what they'd say a liberal academic to see the failure in trying to pick out various texts or so, because again my uncle had sort of shown me the wrongs in that.
Yes, I suppose you could actually pick out bits for what any argument you wanted.
Oh yes, because the soldier wasn't disapproved.